God doesn't do morality. He does ethics.
Morality and ethics. Today on In the Shadow of the Cross. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of In the Shadow of the Cross. I am Lauren Rosser. I'm here once again with my friends Jim Durkin.
Hello.
And Michael Harden.
Hello.
And we are continuing our discussion from last week where we opened yet another can of worms. We're just really good at this, of talking about morality and what place, if any, does that have in Christianity, in following Jesus, in those kinds of arenas. And Jim, you had some thoughts on the topic, so I'm going to go ahead and toss it over to you.
Yeah, I was listening to a talk that Michael gave at a gathering in Dallas here a few weeks ago with a group of, I think I may be a little wrong on this, but I think most of them were charismatic leaders.
Yeah, all of them.
All of them, all okay. Of them. And Michael made a statement, and when I listened to the statement, I had to sit for a few minutes and think, now, okay, but first of all, what's the difference? Secondly, why would he even say that? You know, being a good Christian and among charismatics, you know. And the statement was this, is that God doesn't do morality. He does ethics. And I was thinking, in light of that, I was thinking about our conversation, our podcast last week. I don't know how Lauren puts things up, so maybe it won't be last week's. Maybe it'll be next week's when he decides.
Yeah, it will be last week, yep. Okay. It will be last week.
And I was thinking about that and how fearful for most people that conversation would be. Like, oh my God, yeah. You know, a few weeks ago you were talking about a can of worms. I mean, that's the can of worms. You mean that you're saying, you know, and this statement, you're saying that God doesn't care about morality? It's like, what would this world's already going to hell in a handbasket. What would it be like if we preached that from the pulpit? And so
going to hell in a wheelbarrow.
Really?
In a Tesla. Going to hell in a Tesla.
In a
TV. Go green, baby. Stay green.
So once again, the statement, and I'm going to kick it back to Michael then. God doesn't do morality. He does ethics. So, Michael, you want to break that down for us?
Sure. So, more and just brief, quick definitions without evidence or anything. For me, in just definitionally, morality has to do with exterior law. Ethics has to do with relational behaviors. Now, it's true that the law can mandate relational behaviors, but it's still the law. Mm-hmm. Ethics has to deal with the other person as a subject. Okay, so it's interpersonal. When I say God doesn't do morality, what I'm really saying is God is not holy. And holiness is not an attribute of God, not the Father. Holiness is not an attribute of the Father. What makes God holy is that God is different than all the other gods. God is not Janus faced. This is what make your name holy. Make your name, the Father, the Abba, make your name that you are love, that you are light. Make your name so set apart that you are clearly distinguished from all the gods of human religion. Bring about that separation. Hallowed be thy name. That is what is holy. Holiness in the Jewish tradition is combined at almost every turn with zeal. And it's the zeal for holiness that Phineas, for example, a character, by the way, that plays a large role in certain parts of Second Temple Judaism and their thinking, because Phineas, you know, he's sees the Israelite man and with the Midianite woman and he hears them banging in their tent, so he goes in with a spear and stabs them both, you know, and quote, God, unquote, says, oh, this is great, man. I'm going to make a covenant of peace with this dude. In fact, I'm giving him an eternal priesthood. Oh, yes. Come here, Phineas. Drive away in your $75,000 Lexus. It's stupid, right? So Phineas is this big example of zeal and holiness. The Apostle Paul is another. And Paul denounces zeal. In fact, what's also important here, by the way, if you go look at the armor of God in Ephesians 6, and then you go look at the armor of God in Isaiah and the armor of God in the Wisdom of Solomon, both those have zeal as part of the armor of God. Paul doesn't. Okay. So there's this zeal-holiness connection. Now, Jesus makes an intentional break with something very important to Second Temple Jewish thought. Be a holy people. As I, your God, am holy. Be ye holy as I am holy. King James, or just be holy as I am holy. Okay. Now, this is very important in Jesus' Judaism. We see this in the Pharisaic groups in particular, who are really wanting to bring about the salvation of Israel by reminding God that there's at least 10 of them that gather together that will keep the ritual purity of the priestly code. They're doing this to save Israel. They don't do it to be better than the people. They do it. They're saying if the priests in the temple are corrupt, and everybody thought they were all corrupt, all the Sadducees and they were the deep state, you know. And a Pharisee was just a small groups of men who would gather together and take upon themselves the ritual purity code of the priests, even though they were lay people and they were not Levites. Because they wanted God to see that holiness and thus not bring judgment. Well, Jesus takes this holiness code, be ye holy as I am holy. And by the way, this all comes from this insight. For me, I developed this insight from Marcus Borg's 1980-something dissertation on conflict and politics and conflict and holiness, politics, and the teaching of Jesus, something like that. It was very beneficial for me to discern this. Jesus takes the holiness code and transforms it. Not be holy as I am holy, you're the Lord your God, but be merciful as your Father in heaven is merciful. Okay? Notice he doesn't say, be merciful as I am merciful. He's saying his Father is the equivalent to that Jewish God in be holy as I am holy, the I being God, right? Be merciful as your Father in heaven is merciful. And Marcus argues that there is this mercy code that Jesus brings into the picture. Now, all of this is just to simply juxtapose morality and ethics, or holiness codes, which are all about morality, and ethics, which are about interpersonal relationships. And so can we say Jesus had an ethic? First of all, here's what most of us don't get. Forgiveness is not an emotion. It's an ethic. It's a choice to maintain the relationship, to have absorbed the pain and let it go, and to maintain the relationship. The relationship is what's important, because remember, we're interdividuals, so the relationship is what's real. That's very much in line with how Jesus, I believe, thinks. Second, we might make the mistake of thinking Jesus derives his ethic from his eschatology, the way he would see the end, but it's actually the other way around. Jesus is living this life and comes to see that it's the eschatological life. His eschatology comes out of his human ethical relations as he submits to the Father and relates to people as the Father would relate to them.
That's really good, because I think it's like it's getting the compass pointed the right direction, because so much of what I see, and just like even this week on Facebook and things I run into, you know, you kind of see people laying out these holiness codes, and you know this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong, and what I like is that this puts it that Jesus is saying what matters is our relationships with one another. Is how we interact with each other, and it goes back to what you talked about a while back, Michael. You had talked about that our sin is against one another, not against God. It's how we treat one another, and it's kind of ironic that you hit on it with zeal that in our quest to be quote unquote holy or fulfill God's law or keep God's commands, we can end up violating the very heart of God, and thinking we're pursuing righteousness, we're actually living, if you will, in the structure, as you would talk about, is sin, because you're harming other people in your quest for that.
Precisely.
So it's like it changes your whole perspective, because it's like, wait a minute, how is my pursuit for God affecting others? Because if I'm truly pursuing the Father, then my relationships are going to be priority in how I treat others. So thoughts, you guys?
We do that consistently, and at least ritualistically for an hour every week on usually on Sunday morning, we walk into a building and we see somebody who isn't dressed the way our particular group's dress code says they should be, or it's two people of the same gender who are sitting next to each other holding hands, or it's a homeless guy who wandered in just because there was a coffee pot and cookies, or, you know, and we immediately ostracize that person because they're not holy and they've come into a holy space. And it's like the people that are told that the whole world is going to know that we're his disciples by the love we have, show anything but love. We don't even, you know, we don't even love the four church ladies who always sit on the second row back, you know, on the left side, or we don't really love the, you know, the member in the choir, you know, that's up there, and it's obvious that she's got a little too much makeup on, or we don't really love, you know, and the list goes on and on and on, let alone, you know, the biker who lives across the street from us, you know, or whatever. And it's like, I hate to say it, but Christians are some of the most hateful people I've ever met. Now, that's a broad brush. I'm sorry. I don't mean every single Christian I've ever met. And I know there's somebody going to be listening to this and say, well, not the ones I know. You know, I'm not that way.
Jim said it, all the Christians say.
I'm not that way. You know, I'm never listening to you again.
It's like, exactly. Okay,
bye-bye.
I'm calling Celeste.
But I love what you're saying about morality and ethics. Because it makes me start thinking, there's 100 scriptures going through my mind right now. But this is, it's not only the interdependence, but it's also the in Christ and the Christ in. We live out of...
which is interdependence.
We live it out of that as opposed to a lot of external laws and, you know, the thou shalts and the thou shalt nots and whatever. I do remember, just a wrap up here on this part of my platform, my message. I do remember not being asked to come back to a church when I was speaking on the blessings and cursings of Deuteronomy, and how that is not the way of Christ. We do not get rain in our fields and sunshine on our weekends so we could go to the beach because we've been obedient. And, you know, and...
yeah.
A couple people in the church were bold enough to come up and tell me that I was, you know, an antichrist and preaching preaching against what the Bible says. And like I say, I never did get invited back. So there was probably more people that felt that way than the ones that rebuked me.
Just said it. Yeah. I love preaching somewhere and getting rebuked. It's like, then I know the truth has been spoken. You know?
Right?
It's like, all right, you know.
I
take
love
your comments, put them somewhere the sun don't shine, and I'm all good.
I love when I'm preaching to just take a keg of dynamite and blast a huge hole and then spend the next 15 minutes coming out of the hole.
That's my friend Bob. You know Bob, Jim.
Yeah, sure.
He used to say that I'm the nice bomber. Because mm-hmm. he says, you'll go in and you'll just make friends with people. And he says, and then all of a sudden you just light the stick of dynamite and explode it.
Yeah. Like with a very, very, very religious, always big King James Bible in her hand lady saying, you know why I like the grace message? Because I can go into a triple X-rated theater and sit there and jerk off and worship God at the same time. And she absolutely came.
I know you're not making this stuff up because I was in a charismatic group some years back. And this woman is justifying her adultery.
Yeah.
Because she's a finished product of Christ. Doesn't matter who she screws around her husband.
Yeah. So that, wow. So that, anyhow, this lady just came unglued.
Yeah.
She said, Jim, if you did that, I don't think God would let you get out of the theater. I think he'd take your life right there. You are an abomination to God, and I rebuke you for even saying it. And I'm walking away, and inside I'm just laughing, you know. I got her again. And of course, my wife says in the car home, going home, Jim, why do you do that? Leave the poor woman alone. And she says, I don't even think you believe that. And I said, well, in theory, I believe that God's love is that big. In practice, you're right. I don't believe that. I don't believe that I could do that because I don't believe that I could do that, you know. But is that sin? Here we are back on the subject again, and I'm sorry I took it there. We'll get off of it in a minute.
Well, but, we are asking, what is sin?
That's a good question.
That's the question, and I think it's very important. I had this discussion with the pastor of the church that I go to most of the time, and he loves this podcast. He's right there with us. So we were having this conversation and he said, you know, can you imagine if we started preaching this from the pulpit, the removal of the law, and because there is no law, you know, there is, you know, and go down that. Can you imagine the outcry from religious people and the ostracization of our church now because of that in the Christian community and the misunderstanding of what we're saying by everyone who wants to go out and do whatever they want to do? Like, oh, my pastor just told me I can do it. You know, without this understanding, let's get back to today's conversation. Without this understanding of what ethics is, love works no ill to its neighbor.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's the thing is it's like, whenever it's like, just throw the doors open, do whatever you want, you know, again, that just says we're completely missing it. And then the other thing I hate is the thing of like, well, we got to keep a little bit of law, you know, we got to keep a little bit of poison so that everything will be okay. And it's like
the leaven of the Pharisees.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Well, it's like, for example, I was thinking this morning, you know, last week, I'm going to go there and then we'll come back is, you know, we were talking about sex and all that. And I was thinking, you know, for me, when Lily and I met, we made the decision we were going to wait until we got married. It was not a religious decision when we made that decision. It was an ethical decision because I knew myself and I knew the damage this would cause her if we engaged before we were in a serious relationship. And we're both very glad we made that decision. But that's not something I go around imposing on everybody. However, it's interesting. My daughter made the same decision because she saw how it benefited us. But again, it's an ethic for me of how do I love the other person? And so what's the right way to treat the other person? It's not a rule or a morality thing that you lay down and I take that into other arenas, you know, it's like how, because if love and mercy, if the Father is merciful, then that's our, you know, again, we go back to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Like Michael talked about that the sin was that we learned to imitate one another instead of the Father. And that's what Jesus is bringing us back to, is to imitate the Father. And we do that by imitating Jesus because Jesus showed us how the Father does it. So we look at Jesus and it's basically, you know, how do I treat other people? How do I love another person? And that gets back to the ethics. Michael, you look like you had some thoughts.
Well, I've got a lot of thoughts.
Hold on just a second,
Lauren. Let Jim go for
hold
it.
Hold on just a second.
Okay.
Before we go back to the subject of ethics, you opened something up, and that was your relationship with Lily. Should I tell the rest of the story?
Go ahead, sure. Why not? So I'm an open book.
So these two young people.
Precious, I was 21 when we got married. I had just been 21 people. For 2 weeks.
Came to me. I was pastoring a church. They both went to the church I was pastoring at the time, came to me and asked me if I would marry them. And I said, yeah, I'd be glad to. And I think maybe we did the premarital counseling stuff also. I can't remember. That was a long time ago. How long you been married now, Lauren?
31 years now.
Oh, my gosh. Ooh. Yeah, I think I was young, too.
yeah, I was 21. Lily was a couple years older. I won't say her age.
Yeah,
I'll protect her.
There you go. Be gracious. So I think it was the day of the wedding, you know, just before, or it might have been the night you do the wedding, you know, rehearsal and all that kind of stuff. And Lauren leans over and he says, Jim, he says, something's very, very important to us both. I said, what's that? He said, the kiss. He said, we haven't even kissed yet. And he said, when you, as soon as you pronounce us man and wife, he said, you make sure you get that part. Now you can kiss your bride. And I said, oh, no problem. I get it. And I may have even said something like, you know, because I was still under the law. I may have said, well, kudos to you. You know, you're doing it the right way or something like that. I don't remember. But anyhow.
You may now kiss the bride and steal second base.
Yes, exactly.
And then quickly get out of here. So we do the whole wedding thing the next day and all that. And I say, you know, whatever, however I said it, by the authority invested in me, I now pronounce you husband and wife. Let me introduce Lauren and Lily Rosser, the Rosser family.
You forgot the kiss. You forgot the kiss.
Lauren's over there. The kiss. The kiss. The kiss. The kiss. Oh, oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, yeah. Go ahead and kiss her.
Oh, got you.
The kiss.
Yeah, yeah, really. You just, so well.
Your kiss is on my list. I mean, come on.
Exactly. Now, that was one of those things. It was like, that was just a fun thing Lily and I did. We said, wouldn't it be cool if our first kiss was at the wedding when he said, you may now kiss the bride. Now, believe me, we were hugging for extremely long periods of time. So, unless anyone gets some prudish idea, but we thought that would be cool. And then Jim skips it. He did it on purpose.
And you were sharing the same soda bottles and you know,
exactly,
I'll take a sip,
yeah.
Here,
and
you take
and this. what is this you may now kiss the bride? What about you may now kiss each other? I mean, what is
I'm a man, I'm gonna go ravish this woman.
That's true, no, right?
You may
right.
now kiss each other. It's we're still patriarchal. Anyway,
when we get on the subject of misogynistic patriarchy. We'll get back to that, Michael.
But that's a really good point.
It yeah. is.
So
it
l- is. Let me throw a few things out to get us back to our topic. So a couple of things. We asked the question, what is sin? We also have to ask another question. In the history of the Christian church, as you think back, you can go back to your apostolic period, post-apostolic period, 2nd century, 3rd, 8th, 15th, 17th, 20th, 21st. Christianity, right from the start, has always had one major issue that it has not solved. Paul solved it. The writer of the 4th gospel solved it. But their communities would die. They would die off, these early Pauline and Johannine churches that they were, you know, that were established. I mean, I've walked the ruins of Corinth, you know, and there is no Johannine church in Ephesus, you know, that you can point to, you know what I mean? So evidently when the church gets it, it doesn't seem to last generationally. It's almost as if God has to do a new work with every generation. God's doing a new thing.
Right, yes.
Okay.
You're supposed to say that January 1st.
Yeah. Yeah, right. You look and already you think of the early church, like the Jerusalem church, very much, again, the Jerusalem church, the temple, the holy city in the holy land, you know, Torah's holiness. I mean, it's all there, you know, and they knew Jesus. They walked and talked with him, and you know, and some of them saw what he did, like Peter. But they are trying to fit Jesus into this second temple Jewish thinking process, right? And so they're going to fail to see how Jesus was really reframing things, questioning things on this deep structural level, having to announce the reign of his Father, R-E-I-G-N. And how different the reign of his Father was from their God concepts, how different his understanding of his role as an agent of the Father from their Davidic warrior messianic concepts, how different they understand the spirit of God very differently. It's this attempt to fit Jesus into this law, into this holiness of the Torah, temple, land framework in that Second Temple Enoch view, worldview. It's the attempt to bring Jesus into that and make him relevant, right? What Paul does this in 1 and 2 Thessalonians, he's still under that spell. But Paul will make a major break, and you don't have any of that stuff later in the other letters. But the Johannine author also makes that break. The Lucan author does it in his own way, and the Markan author does it too. Matthew is the gospel that confuses the issue because he's both critical at certain points of the Hanukkah worldview, but at other points he's absorbed them. So Matthew's Jesus has one foot in and one foot out, right?
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And whereas Jude's Jesus has both feet in.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
Same with 2 Peter's, you know. But at any rate, it's this question of the law. So when Marcion comes along in the second century, and we've discussed this before, and he says, wait a second, there really is a difference between the Father of Jesus and the God of Israel. He sees that. It's the question everybody says, how do you relate the grace and the graciousness of the to the old? And that's only because what people fail to recognize is there is that Janus-faced God going on in the story of Israel, but it is a story that is a process of revelation showing more and more and more that God is not like the other gods. To the point where in Isaiah 40, God says, the other gods don't exist. I exist alone. You know? And, I mean, there's just... this, they don't see that process, that historical move that's happening as Judaism is getting it. They're feeling it. They're moving their way toward it. And then, boom, here comes Jesus as the embodiment of this. Some are there. Some aren't there. But the ones that are there that see this, they recognize that what has happened here in the life, death, and resurrection, ascension of Jesus, what's happened there is for the world, the cosmos. And that's why you have that cosmos language in Paul and in the fourth gospel. What is it with us Protestants? Well, it's pretty simple. Luther says there's a place for the law. There's a place for them. The Catholic, first, the Catholic tradition has law and grace, right? And the Catholic tradition is this almost perfect combination with a penitential system and a merit system that, I mean, if I had to choose in that sense, if I had to have a merit system, I'd much rather be Catholic than Protestant. Jeez, at least I can go to confession on Saturday, take the Eucharist on Sunday, and I'm fine. You know, none of the guilt, the psychological guilt trips of Protestantism, right?
Right, and so, it's clearly outlined. It's like, here's the clear rules.
So there's the Catholic tradition. Then Luther comes along and says, no, look, the law doesn't save us. You know, you can't be good enough. You can't be good enough. Even your good deeds are, you know, menstrual rags, yada, yada, quoting Isaiah. And then Luther says, but the law has a function. It leads us to despair. It leads us to go, oh, my God, I can't do this. I need Jesus Christ, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's still room for the law in this Lutheran way of thinking, and you can use it to badger people to show them how desperately they need Jesus. Then there's the Calvins, Calvin and the Calvinists, and No. Gospel first, you know, gospel first. Justification is by faith and grace. It's justification is beautiful, man, and it's God's work. Sanctification, however, which is the follow-up to justification, is about the law. So you're justified by grace, but you're sanctified by obedience, following the law. And now we're back in that Deuteronomic hermeneutic and Calvinism, and they blow that thing up. So it becomes part and parcel of Western civilization, part of our juridical framework thinking and everything else. I mean, it's amazing how a little theological idea could become a societal idea, but that's what happened there. Jim asked the question, Can you imagine the outcry if we got rid of the law in Christianity? Yes, I can. I have seen it, and you have seen it. We have all seen it. Christians know how mimetically sinful they are. They know that if they don't have the fear of God, which is the beginning of wisdom, and that fear comes from thou shalt not, if they don't have that, there's no reason for them to, quote, be saved. There's no gospel message. So in Christianity, where there is no law, there is only grace. They can't handle that, because where there is no law, there's no accusatory principle. There is no sin. Christ is the end of the Torah, Romans 10. They cannot acknowledge this. And they go, oh, yeah, yeah. Paul's just saying that Christ can't, that the law doesn't save us. That's not what Paul is saying. Paul is saying that the Messiah is the telos of the Torah. Period. That those three words completely, they bomb the thinking here of these. So what is sin? First, sin is structural. If we're not individuals, but we are interdividuals, we are relational beings, then sin has to be interdividual and structural, which means sin is that which damages our relationships, okay? My colleague Denny Moon, some decades ago, back when I was a young pastor in Minneapolis, in fact, it would have been 1985, and I remember being at a little meeting with him and Jim Sunholm at the time. And anyway, Denny was talking, and he just simply made a statement, and it was so good I memorized it. Sin is the destructive way we handle our pain. That is our addictive behaviors, and we're all addicts in one way or another, and they all hurt somebody, these addictions. All of us. And it doesn't have to be alcohol or drugs. It can be sex. It can be going to church. It can needing to be at the church every time it opens. Anything that you are compulsed to do.
Anger.
Again, and so this is going to become very important when we do look at 1 Corinthians 5, and particularly from that perspective of Distar Drasko. But sin then is structural. It's interpersonal, but it's also intrapersonal. If I sin against myself when I do things that are destructive to me, self-sabotaging, for example. And those of us, if you look at people that are self-sabotaging, you know, even cutters and stuff, most of those folks would tend to score higher on an intellectual plane than the regular populace. And they're really good. They're really good at, or they've been told they're really good at what they do. They've often been expected to be perfect. And the self-sabotage is the way of saying, I'm not perfect. I'm not. And the need for people around me to say, you know, they're not perfect. Well, then that makes me feel good, you know? We as church have got to learn to first reframe our gospel message, which is about the character of the Father. Then and only then will we be able to understand how to reframe our relationship as a gospel community to a Torah abiding community. And then we might actually have a chance of real Christian Jewish dialogue, which we can't have now.
Yeah, that's, man, a lot of really good, strong points there. Mm-hmm. I was thinking when you're talking about people hurting themselves and cutting themselves, and how a lot of times they tend to be intelligent person in the room. It reminds me of how our friend Steve Crosby, when we were in Dallas, he was talking about how some of the people who've committed suicide are some of the most intelligent people because they have the most realistic perspective of the way this fallen world is, because they look at this world and they're like, they get it. They're like, what's the point? You know, and of course, without Christ, without hope, it's like they're not off, you know. Right. And it's and so sometimes, you know, the people we judge the harshest, it's that they actually have the strongest perspective on the reality of the way things are and the brokenness of humanity and stuff. But they need that hope, you know, to move in. And I think of like when you were talking about the you know, that the gospel being who the Father is, that the gospel being centered on who the Father is, you know, that's why it breaks my heart so much when the gospel that I was raised with and I see being shared so much is this: here's the Ten Commandments. Have you broken any of these? And then the person says, yes, I did. Yep. And then they say, see, you're guilty of them all. And
yeah, the Ray Comfort approach. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then it was interesting because just this week you were talking about the grace and then law, you know, law being that tutor to bring us the grace. It was interesting because just this week on Facebook, I saw this post where it had a picture of two men together and two women together, and it said, this is not love, it's an abomination to God. And then it went on to, and then the same person a few posts later is posting about grace. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, dude, do you know nothing? You know, it got me. I ended up unfriending the guy because we never correspond, and we had one friend in common. And I'm like, I don't need that pollution on my feed. So, no. You know, it's not what I want to wake up to and read in the morning. Here's a healthy dose of scapegoating for, you know, I just don't need that. But you know, even who we scapegoat is based on our, you know, backgrounds and, you know, stuff like that, because it's like, you know, one group says it's bad to scapegoat this group, but then if you're with another group, well, then it's bad to scapegoat this group, you know? So, and I love that, we had a group of people in a gathering we were at that reach out to women and people who've been sex trafficked in it. I like, Michael, you posed a question. You said, how many sex traffickers have you reached? And I just sat back and went, that is a brilliant question.
And because do you remember the answer?
They did reach one. Yes. One. Yes. But the thing that was that struck me though is that's our thing. You know, again, because as a screenwriter, that's our Hollywood paradigm. You know, yeah, the bad guys, there's the bad guys that are out, and then you got the good guys. But Jesus, and this is where we get all mad and offended, because Jesus goes, it's for the quote unquote bad guys too.
Right.
You know, and that's,
well, I would say that's only part of Hollywood. The other part is given us for the last 30 or 40 years, the morally ambiguous anti-hero.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, it's like the Breaking Bad character. I don't know his character's name. I never saw Breaking Bad, but he you know, he's a meth. He's a dealer, but he's an anti-hero. Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, it was interesting because just this week I watched Toy Story 4 for the class I'm taking. We had to watch Toy Story 4, and I was floored because that movie was so Jesus-centered. Yes, the antagonist, Woody, reaches out and lays down his life for the antagonist.
Woody does.
No, I'm not going to say dies. I don't want to give that away. But, well, I don't know. Oh, spoiler alert. He gives up his voice box that there's a snake in my boot for the antagonist, and finds the antagonist a home, a family, and the antagonist transforms into this loving, sweet, you know, doll,
beautiful to
a little girl. And I woke up the next morning after I was kind of pondering, and I went, holy cow, that movie preached the message of Jesus' love for enemies beyond anything I hear coming from anywhere. A kid's movie, you know? And I went, maybe that's partly why Jesus says become like children, because isn't it interesting? It's acceptable to share that message with kids because, oh, we want our kids all getting along and playing nicely together. But with adults, smash them, crash them, burn them. You know, they got what they deserved.
I do want to where I'm going off topic, but how about Gran Torino with Clint Eastwood?
Oh yeah, great movie. Yeah,
the woman that wrote the screenplay for both the Terminator and the Matrix, and her stuff was stolen because she was in Hollywood and in a school, and she wrote the Terminator and the Matrix, and they're together, and they got ripped off. And anyway, there's a whole story, and you can read it online. She's a Christian. She wanted to talk about the gospel in technological form. And you'll remember at the end of The Matrix, Neo is in a cruciform pattern as he allows the machine to take his life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
You know, I love those.
I almost sent you guys a reel that I came across on Facebook yesterday. And I was like, well, I've sent so many of them to you guys, you know, so maybe I'll wait on this one. I could just see Michael's top of Michael's head blowing off.
Maybe we should do it on video then.
It's a very
and what exactly did that look like, Jim?
It's a very large Pentecostal church, and a man in his at least $1,000 suit, very nice haircut, no facial hair, and his whole message is. He starts out, now I want to make it clear, you need to understand this. This is not in the Bible. This is not the Word of God. But it is our practice. We do not allow men in this church to have facial hair.
Oh, the Nazarenes.
I'm going to heaven.
And he went on.
I repented and saved mine.
And he went on and he said, he brings in about how Judaism is all about circumcision and how Paul fought that tooth and nail. He wrote books about Judaism, law of circumcision. And then he insisted that Timothy get circumcised when he went to Jerusalem. It's not scripture, but it's our practice. No facial hair. And I'm like, oh so, my God. See?
So wait a minute.
We're top of your head's blowing off, Michael.
we're comparing facial hair to circumcision.
To circumcision.
So is that dickhead theology?
You gotta go. And then there was another one. And
Cheryl, that was not me.
I love that you're like, that wasn't me, I'm clear.
Then there was another one, and I may have sent this one to you. I can't remember. The guy was saying, the King James Bible is the only authorized translation. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you, with the King James Bible, I can correct the Greek.
Oh, wow. Oh, dang. I don't even know what to say to that.
I do. I have a lot to say about that.
I know, but we said that we were going to try and keep this PG, Michael, so you can't say it on this podcast.
Yeah, I love Michael Harden's Amadeus laugh there.
Stop it!
But it's the insanity. I preached on, this goes back years ago, I preached on grace, and had an elder come up to me and say, you know, I know it's scripture. I mean, I've read all those scriptures. I wished we could live that way. But here's the problem. If you preach that, people are going to just go out and start sinning.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, here's the thing. And of course, my understanding and my thought process is different than it was back then. This was many, many years ago. But I said, here's the thing. I won't do anything that's not already in my heart to do. And so if somebody says to me that I've been living a life of being holy as he is holy and keeping down or repressed that thing that's in me, that desire that's in me, by being a good Christian, by now that I'm a pastor, I have to be an example to the flock and all that kind of stuff. If I'm doing that, and then I get a revelation of grace, and I told the man, I said, first of all, I said, we don't really understand grace anyhow until we understand that grace teaches us how to say no to sin. This law and holiness and perfectionism doesn't teach us how to say no to sin. It teaches us how to become liars. And he kind of come unglued with that statement. But I said, so I've got these things in my heart. I really would like to do them, but I don't want to burn in hell. And I don't want to let the sheep down by seeing their shepherd doing things and blah, 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 blah. And now grace comes along. And I'm like, oh, so I can do these things. It's only for a season. And then I'm like, you know what? I don't want to live this way. This is hurting me. This is hurting my friends. This is hurting my brother. And we get back to the ethics that you're talking about, Michael. So, so it's almost like this stuff within us almost has to come to the surface. Because as long as we repress it, we're walking in something that Paul called menstrual rags.
Yeah.
Self-righteousness.
Yeah, I think of this pastor that I met who he decided to just lift the whole, got a revelation of Jesus, decided to lift the whole law off the congregation, was just done with it. And so he told them, he said, nobody here, nobody's obligated to come to church on Sunday morning anymore. Nobody. He said, you don't, if you want to come, come. But you don't have to. And he said they all thought, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So of course, the first thing they did, they all tested it. You know, the next Sunday, he said there were two people in church. And then following Sunday, there was like maybe four. And but then when they saw, he meant it. He said, then it was an odd thing happened because people then they just started coming because they realized I'm free in this. I can go. I don't have to go. And I'm not going to get judged if I'm not there. And he said they would have some people that would come once every 6 months, but they would just treat them like they were never even gone. You know, when they would come back, hey, good to see you. And I'm just like, man, what a way to live, you know, to just be free from any strings attached to love.
Well, the only reason that this is the major problem of Christianity is you get pastors, they come in and it's all of a sudden you're really aware that it's about the numbers, because you have to have X numbers to pay your salary.
Right.
You have to have X numbers to pay the mortgage on the church. You have to have X, and you can't afford to see that drop off, because if that drops off, why, you're going to be waiting tables or something.
Right.
As a pastor, you might have to have a trade. Mm-hmm. You might have to be like the Apostle Paul. Oh, that would be terrible. That, by the way, is what's coming, because in the next 5 years when we've gone from this debt-ridden system to the new asset-based system, once that happens and everybody's broke, there's going to be no more pastor salaries. There won't be disposable income, you know. And if people have a little disposable income, they sure ain't going to be giving it to no church. Church is, you're about to watch the bankrupting of Christianity.
Yeah, there's definitely some rumblings on the horizon for pretty significant things. And then if you just throw in the giving patterns between the different generations, that even reveals a lot. Because like the younger generations, the millennials and the Gen Zers, they only give to people who they actually know and have relationship with. They tend not to give to like big organizations that they don't know anybody. And so that alone already says that big ministries, giant ministries, those kind of things are in trouble in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and that's aside from the things Michael was talking about.
Yeah. So I know we're going to take on, what is it, 1 Corinthians 5 in the very near future, possibly next week. I'd like to see us.
No, he said next week.
I know. I'd like to see us take on Romans 14. At some point in time,
I would that'd be great.
Yeah, and
but why Romans 14?
Hmm?
Why Romans 14?
Why?
Yeah. What do you see as an issue there that would be important to reckon with?
Well, there's a couple things that kind of stand out in my mind. One, Paul talked about or said that the people that are keeping the kosher laws, eating only vegetables, are the ones that are weaker in the faith. Right. I like that. It's like, in other words, the law abiding, he addresses a lot there about what sounds like what you're saying about ethics, that we don't, even though we're at liberty in all these things, we still don't do something that's going to cause a brother to stumble. I'd like to take a look at what does that mean to stumble? Because, God, in 50 years, I've heard everything you can imagine, as imagine. You're causing me to stumble,
Yeah, and it's like, that's a good point, Jim.
Shut up. And then
well, it's a good point.
And then Paul wraps it up by saying that you need to be fully convinced of what you believe, because whatever is not done in faith, that's sin.
Is sin.
And that's right. And I think we don't understand that. If I give myself liberty in an area to prove that I'm walking in grace, I may not be walking in grace at all because I'm not fully persuaded in my own heart. I'm not doing it out of faith. I'm doing it out of some kind of look at me. I'm free. I'm better than you.
That is nothing to do with grace.
And, well, I know that, but I mean, but those are just the words that we slap on these terms, not knowing at all how precious that word is, and what it means and how it applies and whatever. So I think there's a lot there in Romans 14. I think there's just a lot on this subject.
Well, then let's do that after we look at 1 Corinthians 5, and then we'll take a week and look at Romans 14, and we'll just kind of plow through this until we've... Yeah, sure.
Sounds good to me.
And then, all right, everybody. And then can we get back to sex?
Yeah, I think about that time my shipment of ED pills should arrive.
Don't go there, Michael.
Jim had to circle it back. I couldn't finish it out. All righty. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.